and look forward to the activities. The Innovators Workbench is one of the terrific events that, while we tend to host it on the Stanford campus, I think everybody appreciates it for what it is, and that is, in many ways, it's the secret sauce of Silicon Valley. It's people from around the area with a shared passion for med tech innovation, and it's a wonderful chance to celebrate the spirit of innovation, not just in information technology, but in med tech in Silicon Valley. It's a special treat to have Dr. Michael Kashke here, by trade, a PhD in physics, femtosecond lasers, so deep technical knowledge and expertise, worked his way up the general management ladder, now president of, and CEO of Carl Zeiss in Germany. And when we had pictures taken, he said that in Germany they don't say cheese, they say Zeiss. We were talking earlier that one of the ways that things get better in taking care of patients is to improve what we see. Because there are things we see and things we do, and if you can't see them, you can't do them. And needless to say, Zeiss has been a leading manufacturer, developer, innovator in the field of visualization and visualization enhancement, and so it's a special privilege to have him here. I want to thank Mark Blumenkrantz, Mark's chair of ophthalmology, as most of you know, for making the arrangement. And at this point, let me turn it over to the incomparable David Kasich for the activities of the evening. David,
thanks,
take
Tom.
It away.
Well, thank you, everyone. And last time I was told I abused my time, so we're going to be on a tight time schedule today. So, Dr. Kashke, thank you very much for coming. And you represent, in many ways, areas that we haven't really touched on here. For one area, ophthalmology, and another, we haven't had very many European executives here. But in one other way, it seems to me that you're different from a lot of the other folks that we've had here. And before we get into your career, Carl Zeiss, you're one of the few folks we've had, I think the only CEO we've had here, who came up through the ranks through R&D, as opposed to, say, finance or sales and marketing. I wonder if you could just begin by giving us some perspective, if you have it, of how you think that R&D background, that technical background, has shaped the way you make strategic directions at Carl Zeiss, as opposed to doing it from, say, a financial or sales and marketing mm-hmm. perspective.
Well, I think the aspect that president and CEO in Carl Zeiss is by training a physicist has something to do with the company. So we have a tradition. The company has been in existence now for more than 160 years, originally founded by a mathematician and a craftsman, a mechanic, and always had innovation as the DNA. As the main strength competence in it. And I think in this sense, it is maybe not the common rule, but in Zeiss, it is actually fairly common that the CEO has a technical or an engineering background. How has it shaped my decision-making?
The strategic decision-making.
I think it's physics in particular or engineering can tell you is to make a good analysis of the problem, to to look at the problem from very different sides, and then you have a belief in physics that the problem can be solved, maybe with some tedious calculations, but in the end it's solvable, and that has helped me certainly along very often in my career.
When I think about an industry like the pharma industry, which right now is wrestling with dry product pipelines, generic, the threat of generic substitution, there's a lot of debate about what makes R&D successful and a successful return. Do you think, given your background, you have better insights on how to make R&D more efficient? Or do you think R&D is an inherently inefficient, serendipitous process? Can you manage R&D effectively?
When I get this question, I ask very often, and often I get this question asked by finance or marketing people, and my answer is I know that advertisement or marketing 50% is in vain. You don't know which of the 50%. And the same is true to some extent in R&D. 20% of what you spend in R&D will never see a result. You will not see an effect out of this spending. It's probably 30% in one or the other areas. I think a very technology or innovation focused company like ours can, I would say, can have a success rate of that 80% of the investments in R&D actually yield good results, meaning good products in the, on the market. And I think this has to do with organizing a good pipeline, a good innovation process, but also an innovation culture that you have to have in the company.
Do you think that your background gives you greater respect for the product development, product innovation process than a CEO with a different background? Or conversely, does it help you demystify the process in the way that someone with a sales and marketing or finance who doesn't really understand R&D, do you have a kind of indulgence for the R&D guys, or do you say, look, guys, I really know what's going on here. Let's not kid ourselves. We've got to do better next time.
I think it's both. Yeah, it's, it certainly helps to in discussions when it comes to strategic product decisions, when it comes to investment decisions. It helps to be relatively close to the problem. But also, as I said before, it's the methodology you have as a physicist or as an R&D, a person who grew up through R&D, that you understand the methodology. That helps definitely. Yeah.
So let's talk about your career. Carl Zeiss is the only company you've been with, although you did do a little bit of time at IBM. Talk about your early career at Carl Zeiss, how you got to Carl Zeiss. What did you do at IBM, and how did that lead to a career at Carl Zeiss?
Before I worked for IBM in the high power laser field for semicon applications, so this was a bit of a detour. Actually, I mentioned it earlier this afternoon. I went out of the academic field into the industrial field, having completed my PhD in femtosecond laser physics, because I did not believe my professor at this point of time that the femtosecond lasers would ever find a real application. Today we're making products ourselves in the company with which we operate on ICE. So I was proven wrong. But my decision was to do something more practical and working in the industry. And I found an early interest in medical technology at Zeiss. Worked in the corporate research department, which I think is a benefit of a company like ours, having a corporate or advanced research program, which is a good entry door for many graduates, because it's still a little bit research, it's still a little bit academic, but it has a touch and a flavor of the industry. It's almost like a bit of a venture environment. This was my starting point at early starting point at Zeiss.
What were some of the first technologies you worked on at Carl Zeiss?
Well, the first one, the one I was actually hired for, was the one a project which only lasted 4 months or 5 months, and I ended myself. I was supposed to build an X-ray microscope, a source for an X-ray microscope, a portable X-ray microscope, which you could probably sell to 10, 15. People in the world, so that wasn't a real good project. I went to the board and said, "I can complete the project. We can do it. Technologically, it's possible, but it won't do us any good as a company." And so I was without any project after 4 months. 5 months I started, and I looked for other opportunities. This was a good thing in the corporate research. If you found money, you could look for yourself. And this is what I mean by innovation culture. It's good to give a little bit of play money to the researchers. And we looked for innovative diagnostic methods for breast cancer detection, but also other infrared methodologies.
Were those projects already within Carl Zeiss, or did you bring them into Carl Zeiss?
In both cases we had projects within Carl Zeiss, which I sort of further developed, and projects which I brought into Carl Zeiss as well.
So I know that Zeiss has a wide range of different areas. What percentage of its focus or business comes from the medical technology space?
25% roughly.
Of the from the medical technology space. You told me that the kind of a mantra or mission of Zeiss is that when you want to image something better, turn to Zeiss. What does that mean in the context of what Zeiss is trying to accomplish?
I think this is true for many divisions, not just the medical division of ZEISS. We have in our company claim the slogan, we make it visible. Visualization has been a theme of the company almost from the very beginning. I mean, the founder built the first microscope with new methods, then had hired a mathematician who calculated the microscope. It's actually an interesting story. The microscopes in the 1860s were basically done by trial and error. There was no design methodology as such. And then he, as I said, Carl Zeiss hired Ernst Abbe, one of the other co-founders, to calculate the microscope. And he did a wonderful job, developed the theory of a microscope, which you now find in all textbooks. And Carl Zeiss built the microscope exactly according to the formula of Ernst Abbe. But the result was the microscopes he produced were worse than the ones he had produced by trial and error. And the reason was simply that he overlooked that Ernst Abbe had calculated the microscopes assuming perfect glasses, which didn't exist at this point of time. And then another founder of the company came into a place named Otto Schott, probably known to some of you, Schott company, who manufactured perfect glasses or glasses according to certain specifications. And only then after all three ingredients came together, the mechanical engineering ingenuity by Carl Zeiss, mathematical aspects of Ernst Abbe, and the glasses by Otto Schott all together made Zeiss famous and created the well-known Zeiss microscopes, which is basically the mantra, as you said, or the DNA of Zeiss. We make it visible.
And that makes it, that's applicable not just in medical technology, no, but through in all aspects?
I would say almost all divisions of Zeiss. What probably most people don't know here in the Silicon Valley, that 80% of the chips manufactured worldwide are manufactured by optical lithography lenses made by Carl Zeiss. And this is where we basically image nanostructures of today 26 nanometers onto a chip and onto a wafer. And again, we make these things visible. Mm-hmm.
So you told me when we talked earlier that as you moved through the 1990s and were working at Zeiss, you never actually aspired to be CEO. You would have been happy just running the R&D department, but that Zeiss itself was going through some difficult times during the 1990s. What were they, and how did that affect your career advancement at Zeiss?
Yeah, it's true. All I wanted to be is maybe become the head of R&D at Zeiss. Zeiss in the mid-90s, as you mentioned, had a difficult phase. Brought about or triggered by the reunification. And again, as probably many people don't know, Zeiss was divided after the war into two companies, Zeiss East Germany and the Zeiss West Germany. And both companies fought against each other for more than 40 years in court about brand rights, patent rights, etc. And now they had to be reunited again, which was an tremendous task, which did cost a lot of money, a task which was almost above the financial potential of Zeiss. We're owned by a foundation, so we cannot easily have access to outside capital. So we had to finance this tremendous task from our own resources, and that was the reason for the difficult time. We managed it. It was also for me personally a very interesting time. And when I meet politicians in Germany, I always tell them what Germany had to go through as a country, exactly. we did on a company base.
So why was it interesting for you? I mean, why didn't you just stay in your R&D lab? Was there some impulse? Was it senior management pulling you in? How did you move from a focus on R&D to a greater overall perspective and a larger management role in Zeiss?
Yeah, I was called by the then CEO, who asked me whether I wouldn't be interested to run a division in the East. One of the reasons probably he also wanted me for this is I grew up in East Germany. I studied in East Germany and experience myself the opening of the wall as a fantastic opportunity, which brought me first to the States, working for IBM, then back to Zeiss. And so I volunteered for this reason, but also I saw it as a challenge, and which could take me out of my R&D corner. But as I said before, originally I hadn't aspired it.
You told me that one of the challenges that Zeiss faced, and maybe was part of this integration issue, was deciding which R&D projects to focus on. And how much debate was there, and how did you resolve those debates? What exactly was the debate? Weren't the challenges or opportunities clear to both sides, or were there other issues?
Yeah, there was one particular case which I remember. As I said, I had brought a couple of new projects into Zeiss. And one was a light-based breast cancer detection system. So you could do breast cancer screening without X-rays. This was a project at this point of time, very early stage, probably to maturity 10, 15 years, and was just not possible to carry through at Zeiss at this point of time. And I had no understanding why the CEO killed that project. The CEO from at this time came from Siemens, and my suspicion was he only killed that project because he didn't want to have any competitors against Siemens. So, but the fact was, and this was a good learning for me, at a certain point of time, you have to stay focused. And I think in the end it was the right decision. This project is has still not reached maturity. It's still funded by a couple of venture capitalists, and it definitely would have been the wrong project at this point of time.
So your those kind of internal goings on at Carl Zeiss led to your movement into the management ranks, and your first job was to run a small division of Carl Zeiss. I think it was the surgery division, and you said that you were successful in restarting that. What were the challenges that the surgery division faced, and what did you do there, and how difficult was it for you to make the transition from a pure R&D focus to one where you had to really manage the entire enterprise?
One of the challenges was, and again, a very interesting experience. At this point of time, we had a strong base in our operating microscopes. At the same time, we developed navigation system, intrasurgical navigation systems, which we were in competition with other players who used our microscopes. So a decision had to be made whether we stay an open company or whether we have a closed system. And this was one of the fundamental decisions, because my strong belief is you cannot be at the same time a supplier to someone and then be in competition with the other player. And focusing the company on what we could do best, building good microscopes, good optics, and then selling the navigation part, the software part to Medtronic, was one of the fundamental decisions I made.
You say that one of the virtues or one of the benefits of having a training in physics and in R&D was that you learned how to analyze. Did you trust your instincts as a manager? Was it difficult for you to make those kinds of decisions? Did you put a lot of analysis into that? How did you? There were arguments on both sides of that issue. How comfortable did you feel making those decisions, and how did you come about to making those decisions?
When I say the analytical methodology helps, that doesn't mean that I overanalyze or get into paralysis by analysis. That's not what I mean. I think a good analysis is always also based on discussions with your people, on-site discussions with customers. So I think it's the analytical process which I mean is important. Not so much that you want to have a very rigid and very structured analytical method. I trust to a certain extent. Also trust my instincts. You have to.
So, after running the surgery division, you began to move up, by 1999, you were running the entire medical product groups, a group that it looks like you just about quadrupled sales between 1999 and right now. What were you doing in running the entire medical products group, and what was behind that success?
A couple of challenges. First, the medical group outset was basically a group, an assembly of individually operating divisions. And putting this together and forming it into a medical group with a common strategy and a common philosophy, I would say, was one of the reasons behind the enormous growth we've seen.
What were those divisions?
We had an ophthalmology division. We had a neurosurgical division. We had through an acquisition an intraocular lens division. And we had a diagnostic division here, actually, in Dublin, California, here on north of the Bay. Right. And so putting all these together into a medical group was one of the challenges. And along with these, with a common strategy, then you have to think about common processes, a common presentation to customers, a common R&D methodology. So these are all the... It's not rocket science, but it's a lot of tedious work.
How far did you integrate and how far did you let those individual businesses run? Ophthalmology and neurosurgery are very different businesses from the customer's point of view, but I could see there were synergies. Where did you... We last time here we had Alex Gorsky and Johnson & Johnson is fabled for its decentralized approach. There's other companies that do try to really kind of centralize or coordinate. How did you wrestle with that decentralization versus centralization issue?
It's a good question, and I don't think there's truth in a total decentralization or in the opposite. I think you have to find the right balance. We've given... former president of our division here in Dublin, California, is in the room. We've given the locations and the divisions always a fair amount of independence. Certain things, I think, have to be centralized, like how do you appear on the market, the brand strategy, how do you market your products. Also the certain design philosophies. Otherwise, you cannot appear as one company on the market, as a strong player on the market. But then certain things you should, especially when it comes to innovation, you have to leave room and freedom to local organizations.
So you mentioned the Dublin, California facility, which was an acquisition. You told me that while Zeiss does do some M&A, you told me that solid businesses are built on organic growth and R&D. As I think about some of the CEOs we've had here and about the device industry in general, that seems to me about as contrarian a view as we've seen. This is an industry that has been built on M&A, and I don't think there are very many companies in this industry that have grown. Talk a little bit about where M&A fits in Zeiss's strategy and whether and to what degree internal organic growth and internal R&D can fuel growth adequately for an organization like Zeiss. Maybe begin by giving us a sense of how much you spend on R&D. And
We spent about more than 10% of our revenue, so right now this is close to 380 million euros a year on R&D. And we have about 10% of our total workforce worldwide is directly associated, employed in the R&D department, so scientists, engineers, technicians. But maybe the other number... we've enjoyed in the last decade about 6.9, almost 7% compound annual growth in the company, of which 6% is organic.
Really?
So the vast majority, a little bit more than 1% or around 1% is can be attributed to M&A. And why is that? Again, 10% R&D spending continuously, even throughout the crisis years in 2008, 2009. We actually almost spent the same amount in euros as in normal years. Of course, because we also had a drop in revenues, the rate jumped to 14%, Andy. Of course, that's a mathematical conclusion. But the question was, how do we see M&A?
Let me tee that question up by saying that I think one of the reasons, or one of the fuels for significant M&A in spaces like cardiovascular, has been an extremely rich pipeline of small private venture-backed companies. I mean, a lot of them located here, but located in places like Boston and Southern California. As I think back, and coming hands here, and to the guys from Delphi here, ophthalmology has been one of the hottest sectors in that. When you look at the fruits of the venture investment in ophthalmology devices, in particular the last couple of years, does it make you rethink M&A as a strategy? Want to do more of that? Or do you look and say, really, when the technology bets that Carl Zeiss is going to make in the future really are better coming out of Carl Zeiss than out of the companies that the venture capitalists are betting on here in places like Palo Alto and Menlo Park?
And what I said is our growth comes primarily from organic growth. But then the question is, at what point of time inorganic growth becomes organic, right? So we have done a few acquisitions, mostly smaller acquisitions between 10, 50, maximum 100 million in transaction costs, and most of these acquisitions were technology driven. So we acquired a certain technology and integrated this technology into our company, developed in our own laboratories add-on technologies, and then took these new technologies to the market in the broad marketing approach that we have fueled and supported by the Zeiss brand. Humphrey Division was one example. Right. When we acquired it in the early 90s, it was just a little bit more than a $50 million company. We bought an intraocular lens company, 40 million euros in revenue. But now, if you look today at the revenues that are generated based on this technology acquisitions, it's a multifold of the original value. So what we believe in is that a good M&A strategy is on technologies, maybe not too early stage at the right time, and we can debate what is a good time for an acquisition. Also, in-licensing is for us a very interesting method. It's for me just another way of M&A. And then basically we complement this with our strength, with our innovation strength at Zeiss, and to make the technology into good products.
So I was going to ask this question later, but let me ask it now since it seems to tee up. You are, Zeiss is for the most part a imaging and diagnostic company in an industry that prizes or values therapeutic devices at a much higher level. When you think about a lot of the technology companies that are in the pipelines of the venture capital firms today, how much, if any, pull or inclination is there on your part to make investments or to make acquisitions in companies that are more therapeutically oriented than technologies that enhance imaging or that enhance the diagnostic modes? Mm. Could you see yourself doing an AMD acquisition? Jim Taylor's here. I mean, that kind of stuff.
Good question. The position we have taken, because, as you said, very high prices are paid on therapeutic companies in the M&A environment. Our position has been for quite some time that we look at an entire process. And if there is a therapeutic element, clinical process, diagnostic process, if there's a therapeutic element that complements the process and that allows us to create a process in a much better way, more cost-effectively for the healthcare environment, with better outcomes for the patient, or with more security and safety for the doctor, then we are absolutely willing to implement such a therapeutic element, and we've done that in the past. As a standalone business unit, to go for a therapeutic device or a even to take it to the extreme to pharma, that's not on our radar screen.
So Zeiss is a very important player, a very important provider of very important tools within the operating room. Tom mentioned before Zeiss's role there. You're getting close to being a total solution to in the operating room, except that you're stopping short of surgical equipment and surgical instrumentation. Is there any temptation or any impulse to do that? A surgeon operating at that point prizes the Carl Zeiss microscope he's looking for. Might he not also prize a device that actually helps him to do the procedure as well? Or do you feel that's outside of your comfort zone as a corporation?
No, that's definitely within our eyesight. And we have done so in the past. In neurosurgery, more than maybe in ophthalmology, but even in ophthalmology, we have started. We have a novel phaco device. We have introduced intraoperative diagnostic, which is a step towards a therapeutic device. In neurosurgery, we have complemented our neurosurgical microscope with intraoperative diagnostics, but also manipulation devices. And we had one collaboration which happens in the startup environment, which didn't get to maturity. Looking at Mark Blumenkranz, we had a plasma scalpel, which was both suited for neurosurgery and ophthalmology. So I think whenever there is a good combination between visualization and manipulation, then we are absolutely willing to look at the manipulation devices.
And we've been focusing on M&A as a potential to bring in. You've touched on a number of them, but I think in fairness, we should stop here and just highlight some of the real innovations that have come out of Zeiss, particularly in the last decade, in advancing the technology that you guys have developed. Give us a highlight, a hit parade of some of the things that you're proudest of when you point to innovation that's come out of Carl Zeiss.
It's at your risk because I don't want to share, but I don't want to appear here as an advertisement person. But I think undoubtedly here, and I start with California, the biggest innovation that came out here out of Zeiss Meditech in California was the OCT device, which I think is fair to say has revolutionized diagnostics of the anterior segment of the eye. Jim Taylor is in the room, has been instrumental for this success. But what it also allows me to say this is it has been a 15, almost 20 years journey towards the success of the OCT. And I come to some other devices, but let me share this thought with you. I've made an analysis and found a rule of 4 times 5 years for a medical diagnostic device until it really becomes a big blockbuster. The first 5 years is basically on the lab benches in the academic environment, and this is, in this case, was with MIT. We in-licensed very early in the early 90s from MIT, when this was still basically a lab bench prototype, the technology. The next 5 years basically were spent with transferring this prototype into an early tool, a toy, for the doctors in the field. And the next 5 years were basically to take it from a toy tool to a clinically viable, but also from a reimbursement point, acceptable product. 15 years. And after that period of time, we made some money out of this product, but it shows you how long a time it takes in order to take such a product.
And are those good acceptable time frames from your perspective?
I think so. Yeah. And we have and now to name a few other products similarly long times to maturity. We have quite a different field. An intraoperative radiotherapy, which is a device for breast cancer treatment. Again, in-licensed technology from a startup in the late 90s. It's a device which basically substitutes the fractionated radiotherapy post-surgery, can be applied intraoperatively during the breast cancer surgery. We did 10 years of studies for follow-up. It's normal time, 5 years development, technology development, so altogether 15 years. We're just hitting the market right now and seeing good success. Another example is we had this discussion earlier today about cost saving in the healthcare industry. We had developed at Zeiss the first optical biometry device measuring the eye length non-invasively, a device which substituted an ultrasound device. The ultrasound device was $5,000. The optical device, $35,000. And of course, the argument today would be by all healthcare officials that should not hit the market. And,
right.
The reality was this device allowed work to be transferred from the ophthalmologist to the technician. It allowed to have measurements repetitively and reproducibly. And the savings for the entire system were much higher than the capital investments that went into such a device. So it's not a good example, a good lesson that we had this discussion earlier with the faculty here of the biodesign program. You have to look at the total cost. And by the way, the number, I don't know the U.S. number, unfortunately. In Germany, less than 5% of the total healthcare costs are actually related to capital expenditures of capital equipment. So 95% of the healthcare costs is either in pharma or in the process cost in the system. So that's why, as medical device manufacturer, we always advocate that through good technology there can be cost saving. You have to look at the entire workflow.
But not a lot of healthcare systems are able to get past that sticker shock to look at long-term total cost savings.
Exactly.
And so sometimes that $35,000 unit is dead on arrival because there's a $5,000
alternative. Yeah.
But I wanted to ask a follow-on question to that, which is, as we think about some of the issues that are challenging medical device companies today, one is a kind of challenge to innovation that wraps around emerging markets. And there's a lot of talk today about real growth coming in the so-called BRIC countries, particularly India and China, but that the technology required there or best sold there, best meeting their needs, represents a kind of pullback from the kind of very high outcome-oriented healthcare. GE has coined a phrase, reverse innovation, and talks about a 50% solution and 15% price. When you think about the kind of innovation that has driven Carl Zeiss over the course of the last couple of years, and think about the booming markets in India and China, which I'm not certain where the institutional healthcare system there does. Are the kinds of technologies that you've been developing that success at Zeiss has rested upon, are they relevant to those emerging markets? Do you have plans for China and India? Are you there right now?
Yeah, we are already there. It's a good question whether our technology approach in the past is the right one that can help us in the countries you mentioned. It's a good question and probably worth spending some time to think about it. But the very pragmatic approach is you have to be there. And we went there. We have both in Bangalore in India and in Shanghai, China, centers for application research and innovation centers. What we do there is that we really ask people there to come up with a product, starting from the product definition, that should be launched first in this market, but then taken to the world market. So what we do not do is that we take a product which was current 10 years ago, take it to India or China, defeature it and reverse engineer it and bring it in a cost down to 50%, I don't think this will do the job. And, the approach is actually even more leapfrogging, that we say do not just develop a product for the India market, but develop a product that should have a success here. If it's successful here, we will then take it as a global product. And that is our approach, which we started 2.5 years ago, but a long way to go.
So your list of technology innovations is in no way an advertisement. You've been tremendously successful. You told me that your market share in your neurology products went from 40% to 80%, in ophthalmology at 60%. Those are extraordinarily nice barometers of success. How volatile are market shares? How much does technology change in these space? How sustainable is that success in this space? When you think about sustaining an 80% market share after having gone from 40 to 80%, what do you think your challenges are in that regard?
This is in neurosurgery, as you mentioned, there we have really a formidable position. Whether it's sustainable in the long run, this is a relatively small market, so therefore not too many competitors. In ophthalmology, we see a slightly different situation, that there is basically, I see two trends. One is a lot of smaller, very focused on one technology, focused technology companies. Don't even want to use the word startups because they're beyond the startup phase.
Right.
And on the other hand, large players who start to form alliances and to start to form bringing technologies together that they, in their innovation approach, could not develop themselves. And this goes back to your M&A question from before. Here we are in the middle, basically. We're doing a lot of the innovation ourselves. We don't have the deep pockets and also not in our nature to acquire big other players. And then on the other hand, we have the smaller companies, very focused, very dynamic, driving one or the other technology. In this segment, we have to find good ways of getting a hold of innovations early. We also have to develop skills, how we integrate or at least attach these companies and to Zeiss. That doesn't always have to be, as I said, an acquisition. It can also be an in-licensing. It can be a technology collaboration. And we have to be more flexible in order to maintain our position.
So going back to your career at Zeiss, you were running the medical products group till about 2010, and then you were named CEO last year of 2011. How did that come about, and what were the kind of first challenges or first issues? What were the first things you felt you needed to do as CEO of this organization?
Probably the biggest difficulty I encountered was if you get on the CEO position of a very successful company, then you ask yourself, what do you change? And you have to change something, right? And otherwise, they don't make you CEO. Yeah, exactly. So I think that may sound a bit funny, but it indeed was a challenge I had to ask, or a question I had to ask myself is, there are things that we need to change in order to stay successful. And after a very successful decade of Zeiss, this brought me to, the analysis brought me to three things. Zeiss still is by nature, and I think Jim Taylor will agree with me, still a very German company. Mm-hmm. We have gone global. We have now 50% of our employees outside Germany, but it's still from the way we are acting, we're still a German engineering company with all the virtues.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Those of you who drive a German car will know what I mean, with all the virtues and
probably more than a few here drive German cars,
but also with all the problems in the modern global world. So I have one of the conclusions I came to was Zeiss has to become, in the way we act, in the way we lead the company, much more global.
But what did that mean specifically? Was that a cultural change? Was it an issue of putting resources in different places?
I mentioned resources, for instance, opening these innovation centers in some countries. We have the plan to have two or three divisions headquartered outside Germany. Diversity in the management is an issue. We have from the top 100 managers of the company, still 60, 65. 65% or 65 are German, only 35 are non-Germans. So all these aspects have to come together in order to make the company more global.
You said to me at one point that you also felt that for all of Carl Zeiss's success, the company had become a bit complacent and lost its edge in R&D. How real did you see that as an issue, and what specific steps do you take to do that? Is that going back and reinvigorating what was best about Carl Zeiss, or is it bringing in outside influences and forces that can shake things up a bit?
We have a very strange form of complacency at Zeiss that we have with these successful products, also a belief in the company that when our product hit the market, then it will be just right. It will be just perfect. So that creates, on the one hand, a perfectionism. On the other hand, a certain complacency that we can take our time because, in the end, we will come out with the better product. And this is where I see the risk that one has to play with both aspects: time to market and perfect product. And finding here the right balance. And I think this can differ from product to product. It can differ from country to country. Here, finding the right balance is a challenge for Zeiss. I don't want to say other companies. Bring imperfect products out into the market, but I think Zeiss is known for having the solution just right, just perfect when the product hits the market. That has been the aura of the brand over 160 years.
And one other issue, I think specific to Zeiss, and I said before, there are a lot of things that make you different and unique among the CEOs out here, is that you're not publicly traded. You're a very large company, but you're actually owned by a foundation, and that puts some limitations on what you can do. You said to me that it's hard to do big deals and it's hard to move in big spaces like cardiovascular and diagnostic imaging. What is managing that aspect of Carl Zeiss do? How does that shape your strategy going forward?
Yeah, we are now a €4 billion, $5 billion company, so owned by a foundation, which puts a limit to in terms of can we have access to equity? We can, of course, have debt on the balance sheet, no problem, as long as we can pay the interest. As with any other companies, but the equity is limited because the foundation cannot issue new capital. So all the equity we have in the company has to be generated by the company. On the flip side, which is a positive side here, there is only a relatively small percentage of our earnings, less than 10%, which is distributed to the foundation for their job, for their tasks as a foundation to promote science and to do certain social projects. I see this not so much as a limitation. I just see this as a good guideline for how to manage the company, because I see actually a benefit in this setup. Again, on the positive flip side here, it allows us to follow and pursue projects with a much longer perspective, with a much longer view than might be possible in a publicly traded company. And I mentioned a few of the R&D projects, OCT, the intraoperative radiotherapy, all projects that have been on the list of on the management agenda for 10, 15 years, with periods of time where there was no profit, but still the funding was given, the funding was approved. And I think this I see as a real virtue of such a foundation-owned company.
Does the foundation hold you the same kind of quarterly results that and performance that a typical publicly traded company would?
We file even monthly reports to the foundation. We have the same governance structure as a normal stockholding company in Germany, because with the exception that all our stock is owned by the foundation, so we fulfill exactly the same obligations as any other company. It's just that the shareholder is a relatively quiet shareholder, it's just a foundation, as I call it, but with a clear demand for dividends. And a clear limitation, that is, the equity has to be generated within the company.
Great. We're running up close against time here. I want to invite anyone who's got a question to come to the microphone and ask it. While people are going to the microphone, let me ask one, however, and that is that Zeiss grew up in and became a leader in a world that was driven by a certain kind of technology. And we're now in a world that's gone digital. In the consumer side, we've seen companies like mm-hmm. Kodak and Xerox struggle to adapt to a digital world because they couldn't, they didn't really know how to wrap their minds around it. How did Zeiss, by all measures, Zeiss did a better job of adapting that. Mm-hmm. How has Zeiss dealt with a world that has gone digital?
Yeah, fortunately, most of the digital devices, for two reasons, we have done quite well. Most of the digital devices still need some sort of an optical interface. Mm-hmm. If you look at your cell phone, or if you look at your camera, your digital camera. And the other thing is, in order to produce these digital devices, you need optical technology. Most people don't know. The only way to manufacture the kind of ICs we have today in our in our iPads and iPhones is through optical technology. So I think we have benefited actually from the digital revolution. But I see the risk. I mean, if you just take a simple example, just seen by just got presented by the Nokia top management, a cell phone with a 41 megapixel chip in it. You don't need a zoom lens anymore, right? Because you do everything, all the zooms you want to have is you do digital. So that will put a new challenge to the optical technologies. So we're not without challenges, let me put this way.
Let me ask, we have a question right here.
Yeah, followed along that line, with all the computer algorithm, do you have anything like making a chip lens? You could reprocessing and give you a very good picture. Do you have any direction attacking that area?
A very good question. And as you said, it just followed what my last comment. We have actually, 3 years ago, we have founded and support a chair, a professorship in the chair at the University of Jena for computational optics. I do see this as a very interesting field. Very promising field, and this is definitely very relevant for our future.
Do you think the way Zeiss accumulates and manages images in the future will change substantially? As you said, the company goes back to the 1860s. Mm-hmm. Do you think the way we accumulate and gather images in say 2020 will be significantly different than the way we do in 2012?
The way we gather, probably yes, and this goes along the line. So I think there will be the difference between electronics and optics the borderline between electronics and optics will vanish. That I see. What I don't think will change the way is how we look at pictures and images. So I think there will be in the end. Speaking now about the doctors. There will still be the same judgment. There will be a lot of aided image processing, which will aid the evaluation of images. But in the end, it will still be a visualization by the person, and so that aspect will not go away. And then image quality is still a decisive factor.
Any other questions? Well, here's another question right here.
Thank you for a great talk. I have a question about the cultural change that you want to cause in Zeiss going forward. Right. Culture is one of the most sticky things in any organization, like 160-year-old organization would take a long time. So I understand what you're trying to do, three divisions outside Germany and so on and so forth, but can you say what strategy you're using, for example, changing the HR practices or changing any and other practices which actually convert into culture over a period of decades?
You're absolutely right. I mean, cultural change is a long process. As I said before, 15 years from a product idea to maturity, cultural change in a company, probably same time frame. You can only do it with, my firm belief is with symbols, rituals, and certain processes and incentive systems. These are the four elements. And let me give you an example in research and development, what we did in order to create a better innovation culture. Along the four lines. So we have introduced a so-called technical career ladder, starting from the principal, senior scientist, principal scientist, all the way to fellows, very much like I think in some other U.S. companies, the same thing. Very important, with 2,500 R&D people, not everyone can have wants to have a management career. So very important to have such a system in place. We introduced a innovation prizes every year. All the R&D people can apply for an innovation prize and different categories. My most favorite category actually is successful failure. So we award a prize for a project that failed but still had a lesson to learn. Another prize is for prizes for best knowledge sharing. So we award someone who actually shared his experience, his findings with other people in the company. So that's the aspect of innovation culture. And the third, for instance, incentive system, you have to incentivize your people and honor them on achievements. And so we celebrate great product developments, for instance, and people get the same kind of bonus as salespeople get on the revenues if they deliver a great product on time in the development process. And I think you have to work with all three ingredients. And the fourth is team building and team building events. So you have to work on all fours in order to change the culture over time.
Great. So we're right up against time. Let me ask you one final question. Go back to the very beginning. As I said, you're, if not unique, you certainly are one of the few CEOs who come up with an R&D background. As you think about now your expanded responsibilities in managing all of Carl Zeiss and not just the med tech business, but the other OEM, the consumer business as well. How important do you think it is to retain that strong R&D culture, that strong R&D orientation for you as a manager? I mean, at some point, hopefully not soon, but at some point you'll be grooming a successor. How important will an R&D orientation be to you to look to the next group of leaders who are leading Carl Zeiss?
I would definitely vote for maintaining this tradition at Zeiss. It has served the company well, but it will not be my call.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Let's thank Dr. Caskey. Very much appreciate your being here. Thank you all for coming. There's reception outside. Thank you.
So there's no houseman here, there's nobody here. So I go in there, and they're moving all the tables and chairs around.
In which
rounds,
which
in A, one? In A for cohort for Leadership Academy.
Yesterday or today?
Yesterday. So I get in there, and all the buffet tables are in the back, right? As they're supposed to be. And I go in there, and Todd goes, "We're not letting the people until 9. Can we move the buffet tables outside for breakfast?" And I said, "That's what you want. So you're right. Yeah, we'll move it outside." So him and I and Sergio moved all the stuff outside. So why is that? Why don't we move it outside yesterday? I said, "Because Todd told me personally he wanted it outside." He goes, "Well, that's not what he told me." Like, and I kind of gave that. I'm like, "Yeah, that's what
he
told me."
Were you
here? Well, that's what I wanted to say. Well, that's not what he told me. And I was just like, I walked away. I was like, "I'm not going to fight you about something." You know what I mean?
Ew.
Yeah.
No.
Why not?
Who?
Oh, I told Mahari. Hey, buddy.
That's creepy.
It
Don't
is.
Look at me.
I didn't want to know anything about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I gotta figure out how I save this audio track once I do this. Because I've got 1 minute.
What?
So that dude was drunk. You know what I mean? That note, yeah.
Ew, stop it. You're grossing me out.
No. That's funny.